Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's Global Services Business Briefing. This, as you know, is the second in our series of business briefings, having presented Consumer in May, and we hope that these presentations give you a better insight into the market, strategy, and operations of each of our customer-facing businesses. We've got around 2 hours for this morning's session, including Q&A, and on that note, I'd like to hand straight over to Bas Berger, CEO of Global Services.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Mark, and thank you very much, all of you, for coming to this indeed second of a series of business briefings. I'm really proud that after you have heard Mark O'Leary speak a while ago about consumer business, that we are up next to talk to you about everything and anything that's going on in Global Services at the moment. With me, and we're going to talk for about 75 minutes, and then we have 45 minutes to Q&A. With me on stage will be part of my leadership team. So, first of all, Maria Grazia leads portfolio, will be speaking with me. Mark Hughes leads security, and Martin Smith, who's our CFO, will speak with me on stage. Now, I have a whole series of other leaders from the GSLC also present that are available in the Q&A session. So, Liz Walker, who is responsible for legal, is our general counsel. Rebecca Markovic runs human resources. Ashish Gupta is responsible for banking and the financial markets. And Bernadette Whiteman is actually really new, only a few weeks in, and is going to lead one of our global verticals. Afterwards, we're going to have a light lunch and also a session in the showcase for those of you that want to see our products in action. That is also an opportunity to speak to the leadership team and ask questions. The rest of the leadership team, as we are a global company, are based in other countries, so they're, as I think, busy with customers and with our people, or in case of the Americas, they're probably still speaking. Good. The objective of today, and this is what Mark already said, is to give you some insight in what Global Services actually does. What value we bring for customers. We will also talk about the challenges that market disruption and technology disruption, basically what effect that has on our customers and therefore what effect that will have on our company and the way we have to service our customers in the future. The piece that Maria Grazia is going to do is going to talk a little bit more in depth about the portfolio choices that we've made. And particularly also some growth areas that we picked, among which is security. Now, Mark's going to talk about how we as BT differentiate in security and why we are strong on a global scale. And then Martin will pull everything together in what that will mean for our financial performance and for our underlying performance as a company in the long run. Good. So it's been a while since we did address this audience, and a lot has happened since. We have made changes in our portfolio. Since I joined 15 months ago, we've changed a lot of the leadership, we've changed a lot of our priorities, and after the issue we experienced in Italy in 2017, we have launched a new strategy called Digital Global Services, and we're going to talk about that today. But the one thing, or the three things you need to bear in mind is that the core of that strategy basically says that we as an organization need to radically change our business and focus on a few core markets. It also, Digital DX, says that we need to future-proof DX, and we need to make sure we focus on the long run and focus on growth areas. That we see in the spaces that we solve problems for our customers for. And the other thing that the Italy issue has taught us is that we need to reduce risk, and we need to create a more simple, more agile organization that is going to be less asset-heavy and will over time give us better returns, particularly on capital employed. And Martin is going to talk about that in this section in a lot more detail. Now, good. First, as everybody knows, BT in the UK as a consumer and fixed wireless converged company and a sports environment, which Mark has spoken about a few months ago, Also, BT is known to be strong in the public sector and in the enterprise inside of the UK. But BT outside of the UK is predominantly focused on multinational corporations, and we are seen by these corporations as a premium provider of secure managed IT services and cloud access solutions. Now, we have come in that position through decades of building various assets around the globe, and I'll run through a few of them. You know, we have many different points of presence in the world. We connect all these points of presence through subsea cables, as you can see here, across the planet. We do network-to-network connections between all major commercial centers in the world, and we basically link partner networks. So where we don't have our own access network, we link with partners. That's called NNI. And in some countries, we actually do have access networks ourselves as well. Then we run internet management in over 70 countries. We run we have internet access proposition in many more remote locations. And where we don't have any fixed assets, we complement the coverage through our satellite networks. Now, in addition to that, and all these assets have grown over time through acquisition, through insourcing very large multinationals, as well as building our own assets. And on top of this, we also have a multitude of data centers from which we provide customer services. And clearly, you know, we build a lot of platforms on these infrastructures as well, which we will talk about in a second. Basically, this means that as a company, we have roughly $5 billion of revenue, 5,200 customers, 800 of which, by the way, are large multinational corporations covering roughly 80% of our revenue, and I'll come back on why I mentioned that here. We are in more than 180 countries, and we have people in substantial amounts of people in 76 countries. We're growing really fast in the security space, and Mark will touch on this a little bit. We have 2,600 people, security professionals. We are building a security operating center quickly. And we run our service and our service hubs from four different units, from Brazil, from the UK, from Hungary, as well as from India. Now, if you look at what we do for our customers with these assets that we have, historically, a lot of customers have outsourced their complexity to us to make it simpler. So why they do business with us? Because they trust that we can manage complexity on a global scale better than they can themselves. And that is evolving into three areas. And Maria Gatti is going to touch on this in her presentation a little bit more. But one is the actual infrastructure, so cloud infrastructure and the actual network infrastructure. The piece that we also focus on has a lot to do with voice and video, is cloud collaboration, whether it be contact centers or unified communication. And clearly the reason customers do business with us is because they need their applications to work all the time. And one of the reasons that sometimes doesn't happen is because of cyber threats. Therefore, security has an enormous amount of attention in the way that we do business with our customers today. It sounds straightforward. In practice, it is less straightforward than it sounds. And because of the technological innovation that's all around our customers today, some of these organizations get, some of these situations get more complex by the day. So we have this picture up, which is an evolution of our cloud of clouds model, and I'm sure many of you would have seen it before, with the customer in the middle. And the way today customers basically are serviced by us and others is that they host their applications either on their own site or in their own data centers or third-party data centers, and they consume it all across the globe on all these places I've just mentioned. Recently, we spoke with a customer who told us, and this is very typical, okay, so we have now sites in over 110 countries with you. We buy all the servers. We have our applications up and running for our supply chain, for talking to our customers. And we want to go, by the year 2020, we want to move 70% of all our applications into cloud environments. That could either be in an Amazon or Azure type of environment, or it can be that they consume, you know, Salesforce or Oracle or SAP from a cloud environment. But they need to make sure that all the machines that consume these applications or all the people that consume these applications are still going to be able to do this. They will ask us to help them with the network, which is the lines underneath, to make sure that they can do this transition and this transition with increasing customer experience and not decreasing one. And that is where we differentiate. Clearly, that is BT, and that is what we do and who we are. If we look outside, clearly there is a market disruption in technology. And it's hitting all our customers. If you look at big multinational corporations, they are all being influenced by new technologies, and they're all very scared of the fact that they're going to be left behind and they're going to be disrupted by smaller players. So there's a large demand of our customers to speed up innovation in their network, for them to be more flexible, to utilize new technology when it comes along, and to implement it immediately so that they can use it and compete against smaller players as well as bigger players. Then there's the technology and the partner vendor changes in the market. Simply going from hardware to software models is disruptive, and technology impacting our legacy profit pools where, you know, and Maria Grazia will talk about this, where we have either our fixed asset networks or traditional technology being replaced by other technologies. Now, clearly that will impact our bottom line within global service. Now, the opportunities this actually gives us is that, you know, some see complexity as a problem, and we really see it as an opportunity, because if a customer, and let me tell you this, that none of our multinational corporations will disagree with the fact that I would say all of them are digital companies. It's not only IT companies or web-based companies or even banks. Everybody's a digital company. So that means that if you want to run your supply chains, you want to talk to your customers, you want to collaborate in your own organization, you need to have digital technology that differentiates you. Now, that need to do that and the dependency on all of that stuff to work drives you to a trusted partner. And that is the role we would like to play for our customers also in the future. Clearly, there's a drive also to software-defined networks, which, you know, some see as a threat. For us, it's a huge opportunity to become less asset-heavy. Today, we ship many different boxes to the edge of the network, whether it's a router or an application monitoring system or a firewall or anything else, to all those remote locations you saw. In a software-defined world, you can put one device at the edge and you can use your technology to update and innovate far quicker than we can today. And the best thing about it, scale matters in that environment. The strategy that relates to, if you look at what we do within BT today, if you look at the challenges outside, we have built a strategy that is fully in line with the BT Group strategy you saw in the May annual result presentation of Gavin, where we as an organization want to differentiate customer experience. We want to have an integrated network leadership, a converged proposition, and we want to transform our operating model. Now, for global services, it means that we have picked deep global relationship with a focused set of accounts. We also want to lead, if you talk to talk about infrastructure, we want to lead in managed infrastructure and cloud services. And clearly we need a simpler, agile operating model that differentiates on service, that differentiates on keeping customers up and running, being proactive rather than reactive. Now, I'll jump into all these three boxes just briefly. When we talk about deep customer experience, we have already organized in the beginning of this year our top 200 customers. So just to say, we are currently organized in four different regions. We started organizing ourselves in the beginning of the year by putting the top 200 customers in one organization and managing them, the P&L, across all the regions. We have also decided now to do this to add 600 extra customers, so to put the top 800 customers, which represents 80% of our business, in three different verticals and manage them on a global scale rather than on a regional scale. The benefit of that, it will give you focus and it will give you the ability to grow share of wallet in a very focused set of accounts. The regional enterprise that is not in that 800 group, so the rest of the 4,400 customers by October 1st will stay in the regions I've just described, and we are currently in the process of evaluating what type, if there are alternative channels to service these customers through. There are some very profitable and very scalable business in there that we clearly deliver to large groups of customers in many different geographies. Now, if I look at what we do to lead in the managed services, we clearly, as I said, want to go to an asset-light model. The value we deliver today is an infrastructure collaboration and security, as I discussed, is an infrastructure, very much bespoke networks. Customers telling us in detail what they want, up to router level, configuration, architecture. Collaboration is very often on-premise systems, and security is very often site-based. In the future, where we are, and we are already doing this with our customers today, we want to move towards scalable and software-defined networks. We want to move away from on-premise into cloud services like Cloud UC and Cloud Context. As a matter of fact, we've already stopped selling on-premise contact centers, for example. If customers want that, then we don't sell it, but we will. We still manage them for our current customers, but we also help them move into cloud environments because that is where the scalability and also the future and the stability of these platforms lie. And for security, we want to go to cloud-based services enabled by artificial intelligence. And Mark has some really cool stuff he's going to show you about this in a second. Now, if you know where you want to play and you know where you don't play, it's easier to partner. And it's also easier to make choices and be more attractive to partner networks. Now, we have addressed a lot of the partners that you see on the screen for many years, but we've intensified the partnership by the choices we've made. And AWS is a good example where and Microsoft Azure, as well as other cloud providers, where we're now actively not pushing to our own data centers, but actively pushing to cloud first and helping our customers to slowly but surely, or sometimes even fast and surely, move applications and workloads into cloud environments. I mean, the security space, and Mark will talk about this later, is clearly a very fragmented area, and we partner with loads of different companies, and we pick best of breed wherever we can. This also means that we have areas where we don't play. So, we don't have our own IoT platform. Mind you, a lot of the traffic that we transport and data that we transport for our customers is machine-to-machine traffic and is IoT traffic. We also link into big IoT platforms that our customers utilize, and we make sure they're available and they're always up and running, as we do with artificial intelligence and the other technologies that I've just talked about. This also means that some of these partners we overlap with, and some we compete with as well. So there's a couple of groups of competitors that we face in the market today and tomorrow. So there's some new entrants, some over-the-top players that have specific niche technologies that are very fast to market and can scale up quickly because you don't sometimes need assets. Where we differentiate in this is that we're potentially not as fast to market as some of these smaller companies, but our target market, these top 800 multinationals, they need a trusted partner to bring them from A to B. They will never go to B immediately. And if the technology is superior, then clearly we could in the future always adopt that technology if that scales up as well. Now, traditional telcos, clearly, if we're going to become asset light, and today this is already the case, most of these telco regional and country telco players and some global telco players are our customers and we are their suppliers. This, I think, in the future will be more the case. Clearly, as I said, scale in managing end-to-end environments will matter. And SIs, we partner with many SIs, and it's true, some of these SIs, they build their own managed infrastructure environments. We just need to make sure that we're better at it, so they partner with us rather than do it themselves. Now, the last point I want to make is on how do we become more agile and more simple as an organization. And you know, when we started this journey over a year ago, we said, okay, what do we need to change in our organization to become more simple, more agile, and more focused on the market that I've just described? And we came to 10 work streams, the work streams that are on the screen today. And we just, you can then pick and choose, and you can say, okay, well, some of these programs we do today, some we'll do tomorrow, and we've decided that there's such urgency to change our organization, we're going to do all 10 of them at the same time. This is a long-term plan. This is with the aim to become long-term, sustainable, attractive, value creative for our stakeholders. But in order to do that, we need to do all of these at the same time. So we created a transformation office, and we put leaders, the leaders that you see in front here, each individually have one of the work streams that they lead and are personally accountable for delivering, decided to drive all at the same time. Now, I won't go into them in detail now, but Maria Grazia will talk more about the portfolio work stream, where Mark will talk more about growth and security work stream. Martin will talk about the effect that all of these work streams have on our value in the future and our cost base in the short run. Good. I'll leave it for my piece here, and I would like to ask Maria Grazia Pecorari to come on stage and talk a little bit more about portfolio.
Thank you, Bas. As Bas mentioned, I'm here to cover our portfolio. In other words, our products and services, where we focus, where we grow, how we differentiate. And I will start by building on Bas's perspective on our customers, the CIOs, the CTOs, the CISOs in our customer organization. And their demands are changing, driven by digital. Their businesses are expecting them to deliver superior customer experiences from ever-growing number of apps to digitally transform their workplaces, to enable new digital business models, and to do it faster, at a lower cost, and securely. And so our customers look at their infrastructure, the data centers and the network, to ensure that it's for purpose to enable that. In the data center space, they are moving all their apps to the cloud. This is a well-advanced trend. But they're also paying increasing attention to the network. The network is the digital foundation of digital. It's like the nervous system that connects people, devices, offices, branches, data centers, factories, etc. Of an ever-growing and distributed number of things that connect to the network, with more and more applications and the content of entire data centers that move to the cloud and travel back and forth. And as they do that, they use the network in a different way, and they're using the opportunities of technology in the networking space in a different way. They're moving to hybrid networking, which means mixing and matching different kinds of network solutions from MPLS to business-grade and consumer internet. But they're also increasingly taking advantage of the new technologies, the new innovation in the networking space, which we'll also come back later. What we call in our portfolio dynamic network services, that's essentially a set of new capabilities which are software-enabled to manage the network in a more intelligent, more digital, more insightful, more proactive, more automated way. There are two important call-outs in this journey. The first one, as Bas was saying, our customers need a trusted partner because complexity doesn't go away, it just changes. Now complexity manifests itself in new technology choices that have quite a big impact on the performance of the infrastructure and therefore on the services that sit on top of that. But also skills, not only skills in security, but also skills in understanding these new capabilities of the network, which are quite rare in the market. So first point is the trusted partner. The second one is multi-year journey, as it is shown on the chart on your right-hand side, which gives the example with regards to hybrid networking. Why is it a multi-year journey? It's fundamentally for three reasons. Number one, balance sheet. Customers have made investments. Those are not fully depreciated. They need to manage the investment cycle. The second one is because many of the technologies, particularly in the networking space, are still immature. And the third point is that actually some of the more advanced, some of the more mature technologies still provide things that really matter to the customer in terms of performance, in terms of reliability, in terms of security. And so let me bring that to life with the chart that you see there. It represents a subset of our top 800 customers that account for roughly half of the revenue from our global data networking services. And what do they buy today? They buy services predominantly in MPLS form, which means that their data travels across our global network over paths that are secure, high performance, we can manage the service level, and are passed just for their traffic. Increasingly, though, also they're mixing and matching, so they're combining this type of service with the internet, particularly of the business grade kind. And what does that mean? That some of this traffic is shifted over paths, traveling not only on our global network, but also on other carriers. And on paths that are shared with many other users through many other entry points. The difference between business-grade internet and consumer internet, which is the broadband, the other term, is that in business-grade internet, we optimize those paths and we try to keep as many as we can on our network because that gives us a better ability to manage the service level, which customers really care about. And it's much harder to do in consumer broadband, particularly as we manage deployment across many countries, many geographies, and many different configurations. And if you look at the bids, at the RFPs, your customer asks us today, roughly half of our bids by number are still predominantly for MPLS. It's clearly changing over time, but it is a multi-year journey. The world is going to stay hybrid, a mixing of matching of different technologies, not only at the network level, but also data center. This then brings to the next point. As technology changes and customers use our services in a different way, this then also drives the mix of our revenues across our portfolio. And we have four broad buckets. Martin will come to this point in the section, but let me just provide some color and voice over to this. The first one is legacy. And in the legacy bucket, we have, as the name suggests, a services that are near end of life from a technology perspective. But also we have services that we have deprioritized because they're less attractive from a strategic or commercial perspective. Then we have, the arrow is the historic trend. Then we have mature. Mature is where the bulk of our demand is today. Customers still buy a lot of these services, but the trend is roughly stable. We talked about MPLS. And then we have growth. In growth, we have security. So growth is high demand, as the name suggests. We have security, which is a large, well-established part of our portfolio, which is growing very fast because of the demand in the market and because of our capabilities. But there's also the new part of the portfolio in the infrastructure management space. I talked about Adami Network Services. Here where we have SD-WAN solution and other software-defined networking solutions. And they essentially work as value-added services to the underlying network. So they actually augment and expand the services such as MPLS. We also have cloud-based solutions in the collaboration and contact space. We have IT voice. So there's a number of services where there's new technology, strong demand, although individually from a lower base than in our mature services. And then we have other BT. Our customers also buy services in the UK provided by BT Enterprise, or we have highly bespoke services that do not fit naturally bucketized than in other parts of the portfolio. What the changes over time is not so much the mix per se, there will be some changes, but it's rather how products travel through this funnel from growth to mature into legacy. And this is inherent in the experience in terms of technology in the world where we are today. So our focus is on building on our strength as a global player to ensure that we preserve and we build on the differentiation, the expertise, the skill, and the agility so that we stay relevant to this changing marketplace. Which then brings me to the next part of our conversation, which is around the strength and differentiation. The core of GS is global. We are not a collection of individual countries or individual regions. The core of GS is a web of relationships that transcend national boundaries, of customers that buy, consume, get billed for our services across multiple countries and multiple geographies. These services deliver from global infrastructure, global network, global cloud platforms where scale matters, and supported by a global ecosystem of vendors and partners. As the world becomes more cloud-centric and more security-centric, for our customers, being global matters more, not less. Across different components of the portfolio, as you see on the chart on the slide, both in more mature parts of the portfolio, like data networking, but also in security or cloud unified communication, we are not saturated on the opportunity. There's plenty of opportunity for share of wallet growth and just share growth and penetration of our core customers. As the world changes, it's very important, and this is really the focus of Digital GS, that we excel on the things that matter to the customer, which is around superior customer employee experience, larger solution capability, and also commercial agility. Let me use one example to bring it to life. It's around the cloud unified collaboration. We provide a number of these services. What do these services do? They essentially allow employees to collaborate across a number of ways, talking to one another, sharing desktop, video calls, so on and so forth. We use a number of partners for them. For this service, one of them is Cisco. Cisco SPS is the technology. We host the Cisco software onto our platform. We deliver it, and we manage it for our customers. In this solution, we have a scale. We are number one service provider globally, according to Cisco. We're over 400,000 seats sold or deployed globally. And scale gives an advantage in a number of things. And to bring that to life, let me take a step back and explain this from the perspective of the customer. When a customer, typically a CIO, is considering this kind of a solution, it's typically triggered by something like an office move or consolidation of offices. And they want a number of things. They want to increase employee productivity. They want flexibility because they don't know where their business is going to be in 3 to 5 years. They want to be able to make changes quickly because the number of employees in branches, for example, moves really quickly. And they want to do it at a lower cost because they need to justify the cost of change. And experience really matters to them. And it's the experience of the end user, my core quality is good, I can interact well with my colleagues. But it's also their own experience. Because what migrating to the solution entails, it actually means that typically for a CIO, trust someone to migrate from what is a very vast, complex estate with many legacy providers and essentially moving to new services where the CEO comes in the office on a Monday morning and everything is up and running. So what our scale has enabled us to do is to differentiate in a set of tooling that has transformed what would be otherwise, or could be otherwise, fairly lengthy and manual processes into fast and in some cases near instantaneous capabilities. And we can do it at global scale. This ecosystem of tooling, for example, has enabled us for a customer recently to migrate 17,000 customers over 300 sites in 33 countries in 5 months start to finish. And this is really only one example related to the migration side. We have self-serve capabilities, so a customer self-serve can remove or add a number of users to the platform. We have a tool that enables to understand when the service is not working, where does it actually happen. The customer doesn't care about the technology, they care whether the call is good, the call quality is good. And if the call quality is not good, it can be from any number of sources. It can be because the employee is calling from home, from public broadband. It could be because the access point or Wi-Fi where a meeting is taking place is under too much pressure. So being able to have an ecosystem of tools from our own, from third party, that deliver superior experience is what customers care about. And as we combine our HCS capability with a number of solutions in our portfolio, IP voice and others, we are able to build the bundle pricing in a way on a per user basis, which gives our customers the flexibility that they need for their business. Now, two other points, or two final points, and you know, before handing over to Bas. Technology is like a double-edged sword. It destroys legacy profit pools, but also creates the opportunity to drive new profit pools, new value in the growth area of the portfolio, and indeed also in the mature. So I wanted to bring it to life with some examples, or some areas that are very important for us: network infrastructure, service, and cloud platforms. We own and run a network, and that's globally, which is quite a substantial component of our cost from an operating perspective. But there are a number of changes in the market from a market perspective. In other words, how you can buy the last mile, what connects the landing point of our network to the customer side, which gives us in the future, now and increasing in the future, much more flexibility on how we choose to design our network. Also, there are ongoing innovation in the electronics, which means that the chips that our network works on becomes more compact, higher performance, which means the cheaper to house and run. And so these trends that are happening in the marketplace give us a strong opportunity to optimize the network and therefore reduce the unit cost, whilst delivering performance and coverage and service, which is what our customers care about. The other very important point is around the managed service. And indeed, here there's a change happening in the market. Many contracts is a reflection of customer need, but also technology. Today are still highly bespoke. Customers have their own SLAs, their own service models, there are even some technologies which require a lot of manual intervention. But in the same way, complexity is bad for us, it's also bad for the customer, because it means increasing cost, and also, more importantly, increasing risk for them. So customers are looking for solutions that are more shareable, more scalable, with more repeatability, because that means more efficiency that they can take advantage from and lower risk. And so it is good for us and good for our customers. It's the journey we're going through Digital US to fundamentally take a step back, redesign, re-engineer, digitize, automate our solution and drive demand towards a more scalable platform, whilst that enables us to deliver more differentiated experience at better unit cost. The final point is which is related to the one I just before I go to that, one other point in service. With the technology changes, a lot of capabilities that used to be delivered as hardware are now delivered as software. There's also a tremendous opportunity enabled through greater analytics AI. And what that enables us is to transform a model which today is still quite manual into a model which is way more digital, where things can be done to the network in terms of optimization, configuration, change, much better, much faster, much more automated. Fundamentally making the whole model way more agile. In this model, skills and expertise continue to matter, but when they matter, and Martin will give a brilliant example shortly, they are enhanced by much better tools, which enables us to deliver in the areas where we have an advantage and we can build on a differential experience or differential service to our customers. Final point around the state solution. As this model becomes, the way we deliver our service become more and more cloud-based, they benefit from the economics of cloud-based model, which means the unit cost decreases disproportionately as the revenue increases. So as you will see, that there's a number of levers that we can use building on the changes that are happening in the market, in our customer, in our ecosystem, and in the technology that we can use that enables us to compensate for the disruption in the profit pool that, that is taking place in our legacy, in our particularly in our legacy solution. And last point before I'm handing over to Matt. And it's around the point that our network capabilities, our proposition and our network, and our position in security are closely related to one another, and they amplify one another. They are mutually amplifying sources for growth. So let me go back with this simple diagram to the what does it actually mean to go to do hybrid network. So in a traditional MPLS network configuration, as I was saying before, you have very secure child attacks. As you go hybrid, and all of a sudden the mixing and matching with the consumer internet, you have a network design which has many different kinds of traffic over the same path with many more entry points. And as a result, the security consideration, the risk, the vulnerability, and the security consideration increases quite exponentially. In over half of our hybrid networking conversation with our customer, we also start with the security conversation, sort of bundled in it. Because if you're a customer and you're thinking about how to transform your network, you need to think about network and security together. It's hard to separate the two. There are two other parts that are closely related and built on that. It's not just it's not just a security consideration, it's also a technology consideration, because as all these capabilities, both to manage the network and to deliver security, become more and more software and cloud-based, they're increasingly delivered from the same part of the infrastructure, be it in the network or at the customer premises. So almost from a physical infrastructure perspective, it's really difficult to separate the two and manage them like the two worlds were totally independent from one another. And finally, the last point, which is very important for BC, is that we provide these services from a global network. And the insights, the visibility from a security perspective that our global network gives, it puts our security teams in a unique position when delivering security services. And with that, I want to hand over to Mark, who's going to be much more eloquent than me to explain what we do in security.
Well, thanks, Maria. I'll give it a go. Well, good morning, everyone. My name is Mark Hughes, and as Anne-Marie said, this section is about zooming in on one particular part. You've heard a bit about security already, about how we're really creating value from some of the unique insights that we can get from our global network and the way in which we look at the marketplace. There's three things that I want to talk about in security today. We've heard a lot about the fact that all of our customers are moving to a world where they're trying to consume cloud-based services. And with that comes all those increasing touch points that Maria just talked about. Customers break out onto the internet, risk begins to increase rapidly. So how do you deal with that? The second thing is then how do you stay ahead of the threat landscape. Every day there's new stuff appearing in my world, new bad stuff happening. And then lastly, regulators having been lying around just not paying attention to this, they are now coming up with new forms of regulation which most of our customers, us included, have to comply with. So to bring that to life a bit, I was talking to a CISO the other day, a chief information security officer from a ratings agency. And they said, you know, it's absolutely imperative that we get to the cloud as quickly as possible. And with that, our digitization path has led us to putting over 1,000 applications up in hyperscale environments, and I didn't even know about it. So this is a real challenge of how organizations organize themselves to understand how they can actually get and keep pace with what they're actually trying to achieve. Secondly, just staying ahead of the threat landscape. And one example here, you know, malware, malicious software, mutates, is becoming ever more sophisticated. One piece of malware that we were dealing with the other day was mutating 24 times a day, the MSS piece of malicious software. And just being able to keep ahead of that is really, really, really difficult. And there's one area which really brings that to life when it comes to just being able to have the right skills and capabilities to be able to do this and that's around, just as I said, the people. It's estimated that globally there's over 1.5 million jobs out there, vacancies for cybersecurity people. Now, I look after security in BT. One part of my role is to ensure that our business is safe right across the entire business and well protected. And so I know a lot about this because we're in the market in that 2,600 people in my team that I've talked about looking. And last year alone, we recruited over 900 people. And so trying to find ways to work with organizations as I do, for example, with MIT, and we sponsor the Cybersecurity Challenge UK, where they're looking for, hunting for those nascent skills in schools as well, where we can bring people through and address some of that skill shortage. That's a real differentiator, not just for us, but for our customers as well. And then lastly, that piece around compliance. Now, sadly, almost as I said every day, there's a new situation, be it Equifax, Uber, you hear about all these organizations that are in the news for all the wrong reasons, sadly. And even last week, we saw BA, 380,000 customers. Maybe some of you were impacted in this room here today. And that now, that landscape is beginning to shift. And it's shifting in for one particular big reason, which happened in May, which is the introduction of the European Union General Data Protection Rules, which applies to any organization that's focused on data in the European Union, which is pretty well most large multinational corporations, wherever they are in the world. Now, the key thing there is that the penalty for getting it wrong, for having a breach, has gone from fairly relatively low-level fines to now up to 4% of global annual turnover, which is very, very significant. So not only is there now that risk and that risk assessment has changed quite dramatically in order to be compliant with these systems and new regulations, equally the impact that it could have on the business itself has changed, and we've seen some real value destruction happening in some of those big headline incidents with massive impact on stock price when these incidents happen. And there's one other point, and one large organization, a big investment bank in fact, that I was with recently, and maybe you're in the room today, but I won't mention it, said something very interesting to me, and it's something that I experienced in BT as well. There's just thousands of new ideas and technologies coming into the security market all the time. And what we're finding is that most organizations, and this particular organization, now say that in their core IT infrastructure, they have over 150 different types of security products in there. And that is becoming virtually impossible to manage. So they need to find partners who they can trust, who can deal, as they greatly become digitized, can deal with how you knit together all that those types of products in a way in which can then deliver real value. And also, using the insight that we have, that Maria talked about, that then can actually make sure that those tools work well. So taking all of that environment, how do we go about approaching it? Well, it's not as complicated, although it might sound complicated. You need to boil it down to something that is understandable and really driven by the demands of our customers. So the first thing that I did was I looked around at the various, you know, fairly immature the security market. And what we come up with, the National Institute for Standards and Technology in the US, to come up with a framework for cybersecurity. And broadly speaking, it's about working out, you know, most organizations are one of two organizations here. So those organizations that know full well that they're being impacted and attacked, and those organizations who don't know, okay, but they're still being attacked. And so the things that we have to be good at, there's really four things that we need to be good at, as you can see on the left-hand side of the chart. One is still protecting at those touch points, having things like firewalls in place that can ensure that those touch points where internet connectivity happens and other types of connectivity, that there are basic blocking and tackling type tools in place that can ensure that there is a level of protection. And also, when something is happening, you need to quickly identify what is happening. And then the second bucket of controls, the second piece of controls, are about what I call threat management. And this is where you go hunting and go looking for those weak signals, those small needles in the vast haystack that are going to give you an indication that you might be actually at that moment being impacted or going to be impacted at some point in the future. That's about detecting and then being able to respond to it. Wrap that all up in a what I call graded service model, because different customers have different types of risk profiles. So you need to grade the level of service, which is about how much you go in terms of the risk of stuff, how much protection you put in place in the first place. That's how we get a hold of this. And here, CSC is the way, therefore, that we structure how we look at it. So firstly, we have a core set of services in those two buckets. So things that are relatively mature, that, and myself have mentioned things like firewalls, but cloud security, as I said, most organizations are now consuming some form of cloud security, so proxying services from the cloud, and also using things like security incident and event monitoring tools that can correlate data in that threat management space and allow analysts to go and look for things. And then equally, what we need to get at is then looking and buying out in the market into that huge, vast array of security companies that are coming up. And the market is characterized by lots of small organizations, some of which I'm sure that you spend your time looking at, huge valuations. In fact, there's over 1,600 of them. And what we need to get out on behalf of our customers is when you introduce these types of things into the sort of networks that Maria was talking about, then that can have getting it right and actually providing real risk reduction value into our customers is what it's all about. So having that aperture on that entire marketplace and being able to quickly assess what is good, whether it really does what it's meant to do, and then bring that into through an emerging way and downstream it quickly into core as well, and delivering that in a virtualized way through dynamic network services integrated with those core network capabilities. And a good example there is our cyber security platform, components of which we've had to develop ourselves because the market isn't, in some cases, ready or doesn't have the right capabilities. We have our own research team who work to ensure that we can stay ahead in some niche capability areas to ensure that we have that comprehensive coverage. So those things are important. Making sense of all of that, being able to achieve those three things, being able to get to the cloud responsibly, being able to ensure that organizations can stay ahead of the threat landscape, and finally making sure that there's compliance in there. There are a few things that our way in which we look at the portfolio now enable that to happen in terms of differentiators. So firstly, that way of being able to quickly assess what's going on, I call it the cyber assessment gap. That's what we have a bunch of people who are spend all their day, they love it, they're tech technologists, spend all their day looking at the new technology and working out what's out there and what we can quickly bring into our portfolio. As Maria talked about, integrating that at the network layer, being able to deliver that virtually in those core products and rapidly bringing in and downstreaming new products as well. But most importantly, the thing that I find really works here is these products and services we look at, we test in BT itself. As I said earlier, I'm responsible for security in BT itself. So what that means is that we can actually bring those products and give them a chance to see whether or not they really do what they say they can do. And people can actually experience them before then going talking to our customers about them as well. That's extremely valuable. And one, an organization, a big pharmaceutical company, I was talking to their person who's responsible for security, and she was saying that ability to have insight of really seeing what the market is doing in security and really assessing what is actually valuable that has really paid dividends for them. Now, Baz talked a bit about some of the things that we do that we have to I use my research team to infill if you want something. And one of those areas, which is really important, a capability that the digital market doesn't serve too well, is what are called visualization tools. And this is with all that data that we have, all that differentiation that we have through this ability because we have that huge global network, that means that we can look at global traffic and then we can combine that with the risk posture that a customer may have. Well, that's all very well and good, but how do you make some sense of that? And on this chart behind me, you can see a tool called Nexus, which is about harnessing unstructured data and really presenting it to an analyst in a way in which they can actually do something through it using AI. Now, when I think about this in security land, people talk a lot about AI in security land, and I want you to think about this. I want you to think about, on one hand, Terminator, and on the other hand, Iron Man. And what my analysts are Iron Man, not Terminator. You need people in the middle of it. This is, as Maria was saying, there's hybrid environments, there's complexity in customer environments and how they interact and with their customers. And so people really do need to understand how that all hangs together. But they need to be equipped with tools like you can see on the chart behind me, and I'll explain what that is in a minute or two, to be able to make some sense of what's going on and then be able to respond quickly. Because keeping ahead of this is the key thing that's going to differentiate an organization from doing today's news on the headline and with big value destruction or delighting their customers on an ongoing basis. give a bit of a teaser, I think, that this is going to be, for those of you staying, hopefully, for lunch in the Customer Experience Centre. You're going to see more of this behind me in a minute or two in that Customer Experience Centre. But what this is showing you is the actual data that we harvested from the WannaCry attack. I'm sure everyone heard about, knows about WannaCry. And what this is that basically we mapped out the relationship in real time as the attack was going on between the where the virus WannaCry was impacting and the Bitcoin payments. As you know, it was ransomware. Bitcoin payments were there to be able to, you know, to use it. Unlock to see about that, unfortunately, to be infected by this, unlock the encryption. And this is actually showing those relationships and how they actually happened at the time. And what was important about that actually, this ability to harvest this data, visualize it quickly and do something about it, enabled us to actually prevent wider proliferation of WannaCry in the UK and beyond. So an incredibly powerful tool. And in fact, one other thing that we discovered on this, which the individual demonstrated will have to explain later on, is that we then subsequently went on to find the interrelationship through the Bitcoin wallet, not just from WannaCry, but with NotPetya. We don't have stupid names in stupid malware, but anyhow. So NotPetya is another really important piece of malware. It's important, it popped up in Ukraine, but why it was important is because, you know, once this organization immersed in the scope of shipping something, it suffered tremendous damage. Something infected from that type of data. So again, these types of tools really giving us insight. And these aren't just tools that we use for ourselves. We have one huge project that we're involved in where I'm building the entire National Cyber Security Center and capability for the whole country. And these tools are used to visualize traffic as it happens in real time in that particular country at that scale, which is pretty unique. So bringing all that together, I heard a lot about what's going on in the security space. So let's turn that into some real what's actually going to be happening. So the current business, we're forecasting, is going to double in size in the next 5 years. And why, you might be thinking, why am I confident in saying that? Well, a few things that I've already pointed out. That ability to be able to demonstrate to customers, our customers, that we really do know what we're doing because we actually do this ourselves, is a real differentiator. Not only do we do it, but we also have that unique insight. And through our global network, the ability to deliver this in a virtualized way, which others aren't yet at that point. And that global coverage is really, really significant because it just gives you that aperture, that really fine piece of what's actually happening, which others don't. And that translates itself into some of the key relationships that, for example, I hold with government, and that's just not UK government. But in the UK, for example, we're actually delivering protection at a citizen level to those of us in the room here, where we're preventing and stopping malicious software from actually arriving at our customers' near devices. So it prevents them from having harm. And we're doing that on a national scale. And that's something that we can do because we have this insight. But it's not just in the UK. I was in Washington last week with the Undersecretary of the Department of Homeland Security, Chris Kerr, and he was really interested in finding out how we can share some of that expertise for how to do that at national scale in the UK and the US as well. So those points really make a big difference. And that convergence, just to really come back to it, about how we can deliver hybrid networks. And for an example would be BW Marine, which recently sold a service to, they are taking the SD-WAN solution, dynamic network services from us, and taking security as well in a virtualized way. Really makes a difference. And with that data that we have, enables us to really threat hunt and get ahead of their potential risk. So, turn that into some numbers overall. So you can see that our penetration in our big global 800 accounts is running at about 20% today, so there's a lot further to go. We have a lot further to get a lot more opportunity to exploit and get after to be able to double the size of the business. The market is currently growing at about 11%. We're outstripping that market growth. We've done that consistently over the last 2 years, and looking into the future, clearly to double the size of the business, it's going to have to be a bit bigger than that, which we're forecasting to do, and so therefore confident that we can continue to exploit the opportunities and grow the security business very strongly. But not just about that, it's about a whole lot. So Martin, that's over to you, please, to get a bit more insight.
Thank you. Thanks very much, Mark, and good morning, everyone. I'm going to start with a brief recap of our recent financial results, starting with the full year results for last year. The revenues were down 8%, and that largely reflects our strategic decision to de-emphasize low-margin businesses, in particular global wholesale voice and equipment sales. However, as you'll see on the chart there, general trading revenues were also down, and that reflects the ongoing challenging market conditions across all of our regions. And in particular, the cessation of a couple of large contracts in the Americas. Operating costs are down 8%, and that largely reflects the decline in wholesale voice and equipment sales. And EBITDA fell 13%. So excluding one-off items and foreign exchange impacts, EBITDA was marginally lower, despite some fairly significant increases or improvements in our operating results in Italy. CapEx fell 23%, and that really reflects early execution of our strategy to be asset light. And normalised free cash flow improved to an inflow of 115 million a year. And the movement over last year, or last year's results, primarily reflecting the unwind of improper working capital transactions in Italy. Now, on the back of those results, our operating profit made a very small positive, operating profit. And our return on capital was just above zero. And we fully recognise that those results were disappointing. They fell short of expectations. They fall a long way short of our own ambition for the organisation. And importantly, act as a very useful reminder for us, A, for the need for a transformation, and also to deliver that at pace. Looking at some more recent financial results, so looking at Q1 of this year, I'm pleased to start to see some early evidence of the execution of the digital GS strategy. And importantly, we're seeing much improved predictability in our results as well. Revenues once again were down 8%, and again that reflects the ongoing strategic decision that we have to de-emphasize low-margin businesses. But as Maria Grazia explained earlier, from a portfolio perspective, what we're seeing there is quite significant reductions in our legacy products, and that's being partly mitigated by the growth in the security and the new businesses that Mark has just referred to as well, albeit that growth is coming from a relatively low base. EBITDA improved by 30% year over year, and that included the prior year's bonus true-up. But once again, if we exclude the one-offs and foreign exchange impact, actually our underlying EBITDA was up. And that's despite the lower revenues, and that really reflects the beginnings of improving cost performance, largely in the quarter down to improving labour costs through the delivery of some of our restructuring programs, but in particular the European restructuring that was announced in May 2017. Operating costs were down 10%. CapEx was down a further 30% year over year, and that reflects both in-year savings but also the ongoing strategy to make sure we have a much more focused capital expenditure. As a result of that EBITDA performance, as well as the lower CapEx, we saw improvements on our free cash flow, which improved by 29%, and worth saying that the cash outflow in the quarter is a seasonal factor that we see every year, and so full year outlook for cash will obviously be into the positive again. Now, as I'll cover shortly, we expect these financial trends to continue as we execute on the digital GS strategy and the transformation. Ultimately, we're improving cost performance, offsetting the reductions in revenue, and increasing our EBITDA and cash returns. Now, I'm pleased to say that we've made substantial progress in de-risking the global services business, and that de-risking will continue through delivery of digital GS, particularly through improved focus and simplification. Now, since the discovery of the improper practices in Italy, we've made extensive progress to strengthen our processes, controls, and our governance, not just in Italy, but across global services, across the shared service centres that support global services, and indeed at the group level. In Italy specifically, we've implemented significant process improvements, we have remediated the material control weaknesses, and the correction of the historical financials is now materially complete. At the group level, we have redefined and recommunicated the three lines of defence model. We've enhanced implemented enhanced integrated risk and assurance processes. We've established a central financial control and compliance. And importantly, across global services and indeed across the group, all financial employees have received fraud awareness training. Now, work through further strengthen our controls continues, and one key focus right now as we pivot from the current regional-based organisation into the industry vertical is to make sure that we maintain the strong governance we have from a regional and a country basis as well. So, delivery of digital GS, as I mentioned, will further improve the de-risking, partly through the focus on a smaller set of our key customers, so the 800 accounts, also through the use of trusted strategic partners for them to cover the non-core operations. And we're also looking to remove around about a third of our current supplier base. So we currently have around 9,000 suppliers supporting global services, and we're looking to take over a third of those out. We're also looking to simplify our operating model, and that not only will help improve enable us to have clearer accountability and a more agile decision-making, but it will also enable us to optimize our global footprint. And finally, process simplification and standardization is at the heart of many of the transformation programs that Farag briefly introduced. And that will result in a step change in our efficiency and effectiveness across those processes, not only helping to improve our margins and improving our customer experience, but importantly, will help to further enhance our global control, compliance, and assurance. Now, transformation of a cost base is a critical element of our financial strategy. And our ambition is to significantly increase our EBITDA margins and our return on capital, and further strengthening, therefore, our position, competitive position in the marketplace. Ultimately, building a platform that will enable us to deliver sustainable, profitable growth. The six digital GS transformation work streams that have the greatest impact on our cost base, our current operating cost base of $4.6 billion on the slide here, and in short, we're leaving no stone unturned. The transformation work streams were designed to move us from a cycle of short-term tactical cost-cutting into more fundamental long-term structural change. That will require a level of upfront investment, and importantly, it will take a number of years to fully mature. But our ambition is to deliver at pace, but deliver with the right balance between risk and reward. I'm pleased to say, as I mentioned, when we looked at the Q1 results, we're seeing early evidence of the benefits coming through, particularly in the form of lower labour costs. And as announced in May, at the group level, we are targeting a 13,000 reduction in roles, 7,000 net of new hires, and global services will deliver around a third of those. Indeed, in Q1 alone, we saw a gross reduction in global services roles of 400, and that, again, was largely on the back of the delivery of the European restructuring announced last year. In parallel with this, we are progressing with our asset-light goals, and we are actively looking to manage down our capital investment. On the customer capex side, we're looking at investing much more in scalable solutions and making sure that we focus our investments on the highest returning deals. And we're also looking to optimize our network and portfolio investment as well, in order to focus and drive our key strategic priorities. And at the same time, we're also looking at all options to maximise the value of our existing asset base, and that includes both organic and inorganic actions, particularly in relation to non-core assets. So we expect the momentum on this transformation to continue to build over the next few years. As Beth mentioned, we're undergoing restructuring at the moment, realigning ourselves around three global industry verticals, and those verticals we focus on the top 800 accounts, which collectively last year generated around 80% of our revenue. So, mentioning Global Wholesale Voice, which represented about 8% of our revenues last year, will be reported within the technology, life sciences, and business services sector. The remaining businesses, which return regional enterprise, amount to some 4,400 accounts and collectively generated around 20% of revenue. And it's fair to say that this represents quite a mix of different businesses. On one hand, we have some very valuable country-level security accounts in there, as well as the remainder of the domestic and more local regional businesses as well. And we're looking at a whole range of ways to manage and optimize those businesses, including potentially increased use of indirect in order to serve customers. Now, as part of the restructure, we are changing the way that we measure and monitor performance across the business, both internally and externally. And we're looking to develop during the course of this year a new set of KPIs, which we would look to launch in Q1 of next year. So, for example, we are planning to re-pivot segmentation on revenue from the current regional basis into the industry vertical. So that will be the new revenue segmentation from next year. And today we've also introduced to you the portfolio segmentation to help you understand the dynamics of the business both historically, but importantly as we look forward. So pulling all that together, this slide sets out our expectation of the impact of the delivery of the digital GX strategy and associated transformation. And we're expecting it to result in the following general trends. And I would say before you reach the rulers, this isn't on scale, this is illustrative, but gives an indication of direction anyway. So in the short term, we're expecting revenue to continue to decline relatively steeply in the near term. Again, if you, that's largely due to the continued pull down of the low margin businesses. From a portfolio perspective, that translates into continued steep decline in our legacy products and decline in the other portfolios. And that's partly offset by the increases in the growth portfolio. We're expecting the mature portfolio, which represents about half of our revenue today, to remain broadly stable. Those revenue declines are expecting to be offset by improving cost performance through the delivery of the transformation. That ultimately will drive improving EBITDA margins, ultimately improving EBITDA, and obviously further improving our competitive position in the marketplace. I would say in the mid, we're only expecting modest EBITDA progression, broadly in line with the current consensus. In the long term, we're expecting to return to top-line growth, but importantly, at significantly higher margins than we have today. Eventually, from a portfolio perspective, we reach an inflection point where the increases in our growth portfolio more than compensate for the reductions in legacy. As I said, we will continue to manage our capital investment very closely and considering all options to optimize the value of our existing asset base. And as a result, we're expecting EBITDA progression and reduced capital intensity to lead to sustained growth, not only in our free cash flow, but importantly on our returning capital. And our aim, on a like-for-like basis, so excluding the potential impact of IFRS 16 next year, is to be operating with double-digit return on capital within 2 years. These are our core financial objectives that we're aiming to deliver through Digital GX, and we are absolutely confident in that delivery. I'll now hand over to Baz to summarise. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Martin. I almost had my ruler out, actually, but I couldn't resist. Good. So now you've heard our vision and strategy, what we are as a company, what we do, and how we see the future, and how we're going to act in the future of our customers. Martin has put everything together to see how it actually affects our bottom line and long-term performance, and our objective was today to give you as clear as possible a picture of who we are and where we're heading. Now, as a reminder of some of the things that we've said, we have already achieved various things through the transformation that we are embarking on. Some of the things that happened in the last 12 months have to do with the transformation itself, and some actually are aiming for our growth portfolio. And let there be no mistake about it. We are leading this market, and we are proactively churning our legacy into our growth portfolio because we think we're in a really good position to do that. Hence the reason we are investing in media security, building new cyber operating centers in the UK, Germany, Australia, India, and I'm sure based on our customer demand, it's going to be in more places. We are aggressively expanding our partner ecosystem, and we are also measuring how attractive we are as a partner for this ecosystem so we can make them more successful in the long run. And we've launched three SD-WAN products, and Maria Gaccia spoke about this. When we look at the transformation itself, we are currently right-sizing the organization. Martin spoke about this in our Q1. You saw that we have 400 roles left. Clearly, there's loads more to do with regard to our transformation and towards simplifying the organization. But we started by the front end, and we are clearly on our way by building a vertical model. Important also is that during the transformation and doing all these 10 work streams at the same time, we set ourselves an objective that NPS, which is the way we measure customer satisfaction, it's called Net Promoter Score, needs to go up. So whilst we're transforming our organization, our customer experience and our customer satisfaction needs to go up. We monitor this very, very closely now. The last 18 months, it has gone up, went up 15 points. And we keep monitoring this with our transformation, because I'm a firm believer that if that flips, the customers see that transformation is slowing things down and deteriorate service, clearly we're doing the wrong thing. As a reminder, from where we started and now where we end this presentation, I hope you have seen that there is an urgency in global services to implement the digital GS strategy, to radically reposition our business, to future-proof and to be leading future-proofing growth markets, and to make some very specific choices on where we play and where we don't play, and to remove risk from the organization to create the higher returns that Martin actually alluded to. The last thing I would say is that in order for us to be successful, we need to do what we have just said we would do. And this will require a team to do this. And you've seen four of us present today. Clearly, we have some of the other leadership team here, and some are actually out executing on the strategy, actually. I am really confident that these are very, very capable, not only individuals in their area, but also very strong and committed to seize the opportunity that we see in the market and to lead with energy the transformation and all the parts that they are personally accountable for. I'm super proud to be able to do this. I think it's an exciting time. I see huge opportunities for us if we play our cards right, and the strategy we just presented to you is the one that's going to do that. So thank you very much for your attention so far, and I want to go into the questions and hopefully some answers at the moment. Normally we start over there, and I see all the hands already go up over there, so we'll do that. I invite Maria, Mark, and Martin on stage. We, by the way, also have people on the phone. So for people on the phone, please press star to join the queue. And then people on the webcast, please type in your question or submit your question online. I'm going to start here with a few questions on this side of the room, and then later we'll take questions from the webcast. And maybe if you can say your name and the company you work for, and then you can, that would be brilliant. Yeah, let's start with you.
Good morning. Carolyn Egan from Andrews Analysis. I can ask you a couple of questions, please. One is, you painted a picture of a very radical transformation, and obviously that is going to require a huge change in the organization and composition of your talent and personnel. And I wonder if you could paint, just give a little bit more color on the challenges you're facing in that transformation, how far you are down the timeline in doing that, and in particular, how you're managing to attract and retain people who have potentially quite different skills to be the ones you have to start, right? And the second question is regarding the risk on the security side. I wonder if you could tell us a little bit more about how exposed BT is, or otherwise, in the event that any of your clients actually experience a security breach on your watch.
Okay. I'll pick up the first question, and Mark, if you could pick up the second one. Yes, this is highly impactful for people in the organization, for the talent that we have. And as we move from legacy to growth portfolio, it is also very clear that there are skills that we have today and need today that we don't need in the future, and particularly in Mark's case, are a big difficulty finding in the near term as well. So that moment we need to predict as best as possible. So that's one. The other thing is, clearly we have announced a reduction in the number of people, which clearly will come from automation and becoming a more efficient organization, but also from making some choices. So the, yeah, there's no two ways about it, but we've been very transparent to our people on where the future of this company lies, which areas we think we need skills in the future, and which areas we think we don't need skills in the future. We are actively trying to upskill people to move into those new directions. And where that is not possible, we are working together with, you know, works councils and unions and with the people locally in the team to see what other solutions we need to reach for. And because we're planning long term, I think we do plan out quite a bit. So we can be transparent to our people on what's going to happen in the next 12 to 24 months to anticipate on this. And I can also say that there's huge energy in the organization for many of these transformations, because many of our people see some of the complexity that we've organized ourselves around, and they are really enthusiastic that we're fixing some of these problems at the moment at the speed by which we do it. As a matter of fact, there are some people that actually would like to go faster rather than slower. So it's a bit of a mix, but for us, communicating and being very transparent on the near-term future, giving them the opportunity to reskill, needs to solve for that in the near term.
So on the, firstly, we have to consider the BT risk profile itself, so making sure that we are always understanding very carefully what risks that we're carrying as a business. His reputation, obviously, we carry a huge amount to ensure that we protect all of our customers. And many of you may have seen some of the recent advertising we've been doing and promoting some of the products we have in the consumer base as well, all of which we do right across the group, and I'm responsible for. So then there is, it becomes the question, really, the risk then we have where we interface with our customers themselves. And so the way I go about that is really making sure that when we are interacting and working with customers, that we really get into the details, because it really needs details about understanding their infrastructure, their estate, what part we play in that, and therefore what risks we might or might not be carrying, indeed, and what risks they might be carrying as well. So really understanding who's risk to who and how we really mitigate that in a disciplined and structured way. And that's very much what we bring, which I think differentiates us. And so for an example, I give you recently, there is one large CPG business which is headquartered out of the US. A huge multinational, had a real issue where we were able to help them forensically work out what was going on, where they'd been targeted by some very sophisticated actors, and we were then able to quickly get them to the point where they could understand what was going on, and then help them put the right controls in place to prevent it from happening again. So it's something we're very mindful of, that we're very structured and disciplined about, and I think it ultimately comes back to that point that I made earlier on. By being actual practitioners in this space, being able to understand, therefore, what we have to do on behalf of BT, but bring that expertise with the type of aperture that we've got on that ring side seat that I was talking about to our customers, I think really gives us an advantage so we can spot where those problems may be before they even happen to our customers.
Okay. Right, next. Thank you.
Yeah, morning. It's Luke Lyle from Salt Gen. Can I ask you a couple, please? Just on the MNC contracts first. Could you tell us whether the use of partners means increased competition? Can anybody partner with anybody and therefore there's more competition? Or are you gaining some pricing power from scale? And then secondly, on the return on capital target, that's a pretty impressive target in 2 years. So it's sort of easy to see what happens possibly with the EBITDA, but could you discuss a bit on capital employed? Slide 16 suggests your MPLS traffic's going to more than half. So is there something really significant in the denominator happening here that you should take into account?
Yeah. I'll pick the first one. I can also pick the second one. Could also. And yeah, could you take that one?
On the MPLS and the traffic and the partnership as well.
So I'll say yeah. You can add anything that I say wrong. I think if you look at our multinational corporations, they clearly have a set of suppliers that they look for on a global scale. And if they operate in one country, there's more suppliers than if they operate on a global scale. And this is in our space, but also in the cloud data center space and in the system integrator space. So we tend to partner with those companies that have the scale that those companies need. And we find that that's a small set of strong global organizations. So for us, You know, take, for example, the partnership of AWS. I think for them also, it is important that they work with a partner, spend time with us, because, you know, as Mark was describing, the security solutions we develop in cloud environments are very specific. They will also not do this with 20 different companies. They will pick a few that can scale and that can work with them so that they can offer these services also to their customers. So I would say, yes, anybody could partner with anybody, but in the world of MNCs, scale is important, and depth of knowledge about how we work together is important. So we have chosen just to pick a few partners and scale, and we see our partners do roughly the same thing.
On the point of MPLS, traffic is not going down. It's actually growing. There's as you know, an explosion of bandwidth. We see, however, a shift in the mix that the traffic is more and more towards higher bandwidth ports because in lower bandwidth, this is where we see the migration to other forms of solutions such as business rate internet. So absolutely, the network remains key, but it's used in different ways. Customers are using more of the elements of performance and speed and service level, where that is critical to them. Just then building very slowly on the point that made by Bart on partnership, scale matters because partnership is a relationship. You need to understand the partner. Each partner works in a different way. You need to make investments in training, certifications, et cetera. So commitment, scale, is one of the key reasons why partners have come to us. And as Bart was saying, then these relationships tend to become quite sticky because it's harder to recreate them.
Martin, maybe the capital employed equation, I mean, it's multifaceted in terms of how we're trying to get there. But firstly, investment of depreciation is largely outstripping capital investment on an ongoing basis, as you have seen in the recent financial results, so that will obviously pull the capital employed down. Equally, we're looking very closely at the existing asset base to see how we can best optimize that. And then combined with that, obviously, the improving EBITDA over term, particularly as we get towards the sort of outer part of our plan, will help drive it through as well. So this should improve that.
But you are right. It's a challenging number, but I think we are we have the right plan to do this and underpin it.
Okay, just behind you.
Do you have a microphone?
Yeah. Michael Bishop from Goldman Sachs. Just two questions. Firstly, on your confidence around the mature segments. Remain flat. Is there not big deflationary issues in that segment? Because traditionally, sort of legacy or mature telco services tend to see quite a lot of deflation. And just along those lines, is SD-WAN not deflationary as well? And then just to follow up, could you quantify the scope or broad scope of non-core assets?
Sorry, say that again?
Do you quantify the scope of non-core assets within global services? No.
Okay. Okay, so I'll start with the last question, if I may. We've been clear on the assets we have today, and we've been clear on the customers and the portfolio we focus on tomorrow. So it's clear that if you look at all the assets we have today, you know, potentially we don't need all the ports in the world that we have today in all the locations that we have, and potentially we don't need deep access networks in countries as we have them today in some of these areas. You know, we don't need 52 data centers across the globe in the strategy that we have presented. So those are the assets that you have to think about that we still use today. We underutilize them, hence the low return on capital employed of these assets. And as Martin said, we are currently looking at all options on what to do with them. And no decision has been made on this topic just yet. So on the mature segments, I think you're saying the mature segments are flat. I think it will be a mix on how our customers spend their money. So, and it's a complex topic because every customer becomes more digital, the way in which they use infrastructure is growing dramatically. So bandwidth goes up. Availability of infrastructure needs to improve. You know, customers It used to be okay for a factory not having connectivity for a week 10 years ago. Today they can't do without 5 minutes, so you need to have double entry, you need to have satellite backup, etc. So that demand for infrastructure is growing. The way in which we can deliver it, actually, and also through SD-WAN, so your point is correct, that is deflationary. So you can deliver faster, cheaper, better, far higher bandwidth. The reason we think those segments are stable is because the migration to new environments will take its time. And we think the pickup in demand and the ability to deliver it more efficiently will weigh out each other. Now, hopefully, if we are able to get better growth in the growth areas we presented, we will see that the legacy areas are bottoming out and the growth areas are picking up within the 800 accounts and potentially the other channels we have by increasing share of wallet and utilizing the increase in demand as well. Did that answer your question, Mike?
Answer that.
All right. Good. Carl, I thought you were going to be the first one.
Okay.
You should have stepped more to the right, actually.
Thanks very much. Carl Meadows-Smith from Berenberg. I'd just love to hear a bit more about the bidding process. So particularly in terms of going forward and what's changing in terms of the business. More of a focus on return on capital. How are you changing the way you approach bids?
Yeah.
How do you incentivize salespeople to think more about long-term return on capital? And then more broadly, just an idea of how much a contract is kind of on a fixed basis versus on time and material. And then a second simpler question. Just looking at the change in terms of main report, how much overlap is there between what's reported in the UK today and then what will be reported as banking and financial services going forward? Thank you.
Okay, so your last question was the division between the UK today and...
Well, just how much overlap there is between UK, what's reported as the UK today, and then banking and financial services going forward. How much are they the same?
Okay. So we have market banks for that one, and if not, then we have the one running the banking and financial markets in the UK right here as well. I'll start with the first one. How do we deal with contracts, and how does the bidding work? It's actually... it's a really good point because we have changed the way in which we look at this because our customers do this as well. The way we measure, and this is also something we publish externally to you guys, is ICV, is incremental contract value. Clearly, that is a committed value of a big contract over a long period of time. As I've shown in my slide, because there's more demand for flexibility, more demand for pay-as-you-go, those incremental contract values actually go down because the term is shorter, the actual commitment is shorter, but that not necessarily means that the actual revenue from that same client is going to be different. The way we change bidding also reflects in the fact that we go less after big bids that have large customer capex. We want to prioritize spending our capex on investments that we can scale. So we want to build platforms for customers that we can scale across more customers, more than that we want to build some big on-premise service that is only going to be utilized by one customer. And that affects the way we bid in the market today. And we incentivize our sales force accordingly to make sure that we focus on those areas today. Martin, did you comment on the second?
Yeah, I mean, there is actually quite an overlap between what's currently reported as UK versus the new industry vertical of banking and finance. A lot of those big accounts are already based in the UK. Obviously, part of this, what we'll be doing is moving away from just a regional segmentation of those results. So each of those accounts that are currently owned by the UK team will get the global revenues and returns reported through that new vertical. So the dynamic of it will actually change, but I guess the key point is a lot of the key banking and financial accounts are currently owned by the UK team and will form part of that same vertical. So there is a lot of overlap, but it's depends on a lot of accounts that are currently owned by the UK team that I'm using now as well.
Anything to add, Ashish?
Well, I mean, and just broadly in numbers, well, we're talking about UK and GBFL are currently reported at about, 2.5 4 billion-ish, and banking and financial markets is about 1.6 billion. So, I mean, there's obviously the UK and good things like Unilever and other accounts that we currently obviously would have on the vertical, because we're going to a vertical model.
So it's probably worth reflecting that we've actually amalgamated much of the banking and financial services sector already under a sheet as part of our first phase of reorganisation that happened in April. But you won't have seen that in the external results because we're thinking through the future phases. But as Baz mentioned, the first step of that transition was to align the way that we manage the top 200, and one of these banking financial services accounts fit within that top 200.
I don't know, on the big stuff. I think the one thing I know. On the big stuff, the other thing we're trying to do is disincentivize deals where we're just chasing top line revenue and investing large volumes of capex on non leveraged assets, i.e., customer specific CPE, that sort of stuff. Now, it's never say never. I mean, there may be good reasons why we might be stuck of that nature, but we're not really driving a market outcome, which is about chasing deals where we invest a huge amount of upfront cash flow for a non-leveraged return. Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Okay, good. David, next please.
Thank you. It's David Rice of Bank of America. A couple of questions. First of all, can you guys give, if you're allowed to, any detail on your remuneration profile? What are the financial KPIs? Is it return on capital? Revenue growth, CPR growth, cash flow growth, whatever that might be, if possible, please. Second question, probably fairly briefly, I sense an inorganic element to the return on capital growth. You suggested some efforts you might consider, selling, closing down even though they're not possible. Nothing wrong with that, of course. And then just finally, a more conceptual question. What advantages does global services derive from being part of BT Group? Would global services exist exactly the same way it does today, independently from BT Group?
Okay, good. Yeah, I don't want to comment too much on generic remuneration other than what we publicly do. I can say with regard to our sales force, we do move away from aiming for the deals that Ashish was alluding to, which are large ITV deals, and we much more focus on monthly recurring revenue. And also in that context, we do focus more on selling the growth portfolio and try to disincentivize holding on to the past. So we do really want to see in our sales force the behavior of leading the market and proactively moving our customers into the new world. Because we firmly believe if we do that today, then we're going to be leading it. If we do it tomorrow, we will not. Now, on your question of ROCE, clearly, divesting assets will have an effect on that as well. Well, as I said earlier, and that's actually where I want to keep it, is that we are currently looking at all the assets I described, looking at all the options that we have. We're working at pace as fast as we think necessary to make sure that we make the decisions needed. Today, no decision has been made. We will come forward if we do. And then the last question on BT Group. BT Group has huge value for us, and I think we have value for BT Group. When you saw the strategy slide and also the strategy slide that Gavin presented, we are core part of the BT strategy. I think there's several ways of looking at it. First of all, I think, and this is something that people that live primarily outside of the UK will adhere to, is the fact that the BT brand outside of the UK is really strong. It is a trusted brand. We have been out there for a very long time. We have very strong and deep relationships. That is a tremendous value that we have currently built over decades. And I think as you saw in our story today, that is what customers want in the future as well. They want speed, flexibility, but they also want to have a trusted partner, particularly when it comes down to security. The other thing is we scale some of our cloud solutions also across the UK enterprise market. So it gives us also a scale advantage. And it gives us an advantage that many of the headquarters we service for multinationals are in the UK, and many of the multinationals we have go into the UK, so there
piece of our revenue that utilizes the assets in the UK as well. Now, going back to the security environment, Mark is also responsible for protecting BT Group, and the expertise that he builds to prevent, to protect our organization is also what we use in the bigger organization. So I think those are all elements that we benefit from being part of the group, and and also part of the core strategy. Go ahead, yeah, in the back.
Just a quick follow-up and a couple of other questions. Just sort of come back to the term capital base. Is there capital base published anywhere? Where the term capital base are using is? If you have that number, it would be very helpful. Great, thank you. Secondly, BT Italia. At the risk of getting my ruler out and trying to, quantify exactly the extent of the contribution to the EBITDA performance last year, it looks like it was about 50 million, which I think would mean that Italia is still quite heavily loss-making. Where are you on that journey, and where do you think you can come out in the next 2 or 3 years as a further contributor to EBITDA performance? And just sort of finally, coming up on David's question, are you at all operating under the knowledge of the plan B? I mean, Global Services obviously had its fair share of problems with this, and I'm not sure if your issues directly, but if you don't get that double digit for a few years' time, is it time for another radical rethink? I mean, how do you have a sense that, what the options are available?
Okay. Martin, could you first? Two? Yeah, so in terms of capital employed, we don't actually publish CSU level capital employed within BT, so I'm unable to give you that number today. What I can say is it does include about a third of our capital employed is actually goodwill, which is obviously a historical position. In terms of Italy, in terms of Italy, we absolutely are in still the loss-making position. We once we'd unwound the improper transactions last year, we were making a reasonably substantial loss in the context of GS's overall performance. We broadly halved that last year in terms of the loss-making position, and we are looking to be break-even from an operating results perspective towards the end of this year and certainly into next year. So hopefully that helps explain where we are.
Yeah, I would say, to echo what you said, I think Italy has done a great job of getting to a stable situation after the issues we discovered last year. I think the team in Italy has done a tremendous job in getting us to the place we are, and yes, it is still unprofitable, but the trajectory is extremely positive. I'm very proud of those guys because it's been very difficult to work under those circumstances. Plan B, no, we don't really have a plan B that we think of. I think if you drive on the freeway and you focus on the point in sight, I think that's where you're driving. I do think, we're very confident that we are going to execute on the plan that we have. The other thing I would say is that if we don't get to the end point, but we drive towards that direction, any other optionality is still on the table and will be beneficial. I don't think we do anything today that is not logical or will potentially eliminate any other options whenever in the future. But today, we don't have a plan B. This is plan A, B, and C, and we're going to execute on it. Sorry.
Hi, it's James Trout from ET Research. Two questions, please. The first one, I just wanted to talk more broadly about the general competitive environment you're seeing in this industry. I mean, it strikes me that one of the kind of caps there's been on margins in this business in the last 5 or 10 years has been a pretty cutthroat pricing environment when it comes to RFPs. Is that still in place? Are you seeing any change to that environment at the moment? Can you get your kind of thoughts on that, please? And then the second question, you mentioned there's been a 15-point improvement in NPS over the past 18 months. What actually is your NPS for an absolute term, please?
Good. I'll answer the first one, and I forgot to introduce Thomas. Thomas actually runs all our service and delivery globally. So apologies, Thomas. Thomas Dickert. And he will hopefully be able to help me answer the second question on NPS. I think on competition, I think once you get to RFP, once you get to the situation that a customer says, okay, now I'm going to change my entire environment and I'm going to look for everybody to bid on it, and that is very often instigated by lower budgets and cost reduction programs, and those environments are very competitive. Many companies participate, and many different solutions get promised. Whether they will deliver the future value clearly is up to the customer to judge. I do think the generic direction is that there is not a lot of companies out there that will really go aggressive on price to the expense of anything. So I think the complexity and the risks associated with bidding below cost are well behind it, I think. But nevertheless, you need to be efficient in your cost base to be able to compete and make margin in those bids. Clearly, what we try to do is anticipate the changes our customers want to make in their complex ICT environment, and then migrate on an incremental basis. And therefore, productivity in this space is really important. And for us, it's also important then to sometimes give lower prices, even though we still have a long-term contract, to make sure that we innovate and renew our customers proactively, so we don't get to a situation where we need to go to RFP and compete with the world. Okay. Sorry. Yeah, good point. Almost forgot.
So that give you a view of an idea how we manage, how we measure NPS. So we look at the 12-month rolling average of NPS as you do. But before I go into that, you've seen the 15 points we have done over the last 18 months. We started a little bit over 2 years ago, and the improvement in that time frame was 30 points improvement. And we have an organization built around there that actually takes the customer feedback quite seriously. We're going through this on a weekly basis to actually look, are we on the right track as far as on which that we have quite a close eye. Currently, our 12-month rolling average is plus 8.5. But if you look at the quarters that we have, or the spot check months that we do, then they're around the 25 already. But because you're looking at the 12-month rolling average, and you see the interest rate, that's lower. One thing I would also say, and I think some of the industry analysts are in the room, if you look at what we've done in the last 12 months, particularly, and my organization in service is focusing heavily on process re-engineering, is to look at a lot of the handovers that we have and how we're supporting the portfolio areas that you said earlier. We're looking into this quite heavily. And we've seen quite some positive results just recently. Just spoken with one of the industry analysts just last week, where we could see, particularly in the area where we do in-life service, we have moved the dial substantially. There's much more to do for us to have services that differentiate fully on the team, but we can confidently say that they're active to have the right one.
Positive on NPS, why aren't you more positive than in your revenue outlook trend you gave to the business?
I think the trend in NPS going up is a must in the industry that we operate in, because I think we're operating in an industry where increasingly everybody needs to be on the best when they deliver services to customers. So I think the bar is rising. And the other thing I would say is that NPS translates best in renewal rates, and our renewal rates are north of 90% at the moment. And that is the effect that we see from this. And that's why the focus is so important. Okay, go to you.
Hey, hi, it's Taylor Tang from UBS. Just have two questions. The first one is really just about slide 17, where you broke out global services revenue into four buckets and indicated the growth profile for each going forward. But can you maybe give more color in terms of the EBITDA margin and the CapEx to sales requirements for each of those different segments? I'm not expecting to be very specific, but maybe just give some rough indication. The second question is really just about cost savings. So you gave some qualitative color in terms of cost savings, but it's maybe possible to get maybe something absolute in terms of cost savings going forward. Because we know the group has a 1.5 billion per annum gross cost savings target, so it's global services a large proportion of that.
Okay. Yeah, I'm not going to be able to give you the EBITDA by sector or not even by the, let's say, 10% of the 4,400 customers. What I can say is that there is no segment that is highly profitable versus another sector being very loss-making. Rough order of magnitude margins across all our companies and customers are the same. Clearly, there's some contracts with very low margin, which we need to work really hard to get the margin up, and there are some other contracts which look a lot more healthy. But there is no distinct between the three segments that Martin showed in that context. Yeah.
And then on the, you're looking at by portfolio, total portfolio?
And just slide 17, is a legacy mature growth.
Okay, so just to give a statement earlier, I mean, there's a clear range of products within each of those segments, and if we take legacy, for example, it's got wholesale goods, which is a relatively low margin. Also got some legacy products, which are pretty high margin. On average across legacy, the gross margin is broadly the same as we see in the mature. Similarly, on other BC, it's a mix of low margin, sort of reseller type margins, right the way through to some fairly bespoke managed services, which have a high margin. Again, on average, the margin for that other segment is broadly aligned to the mature. What I would say is, in terms of the growth segment, we are seeing, on average, slightly higher margins in there than we're seeing on the mature. So directionally, that's kind of where we are. But there's a big range within each of those segments. The good news is the growth currently, as we're seeing, is coming out slightly higher margin than the rest, and the rest are broadly in line. So we're not in a position, unfortunately, to give any explicit cost-saving guidance for global services today. What I would say is, I've mentioned earlier, with a third of the role reductions will come to global services. And if you look back at the announcement made in May, it was clear that the value of the cost upside from those reductions, and therefore it's fair to take a straight translation of that into the impact on global services for that element of the transformation. I would say again, because of the nature of the growth, perhaps we are focused on driving scalable solutions, I would expect on average a lower capital intensity for the growth segment, certainly compared to the legacy mature.
Good. Yeah. Robert Bindle from Deutsche Bank. My first question is Brexit making any difference at all to you and your ability to win contracts at this time? And it's actually a clarity on the CapEx point, which is almost clear for me. But the CapEx authority for global services was very correlated with growth historically. Your rebates got down to a lower number. Your growth on the long-term CapEx, so I'm not sure what the exact scale was, suggests that the CapEx will remain flat given the growth picks up. Is that just a timing thing, or would you expect it to trail up the
growth? No,
was it absolutely a flat CapEx within global growth?
Yeah, I think historically CapEx was very much related to customer CapEx. So when we would insource, or when we would refresh a very large customer, and we would pay customer CapEx to the UBS device, which Ashish mentioned, that had a spike, and that was correlated with growth. I think the future will be CapEx in scalable platforms, and therefore, you know, once you have it in place, hopefully, once you scale, and our objective to do that, you will see that you don't need more investment to be able to scale up revenue and margins over time. I think the other one on Brexit, clearly Brexit will have an influence on our customers in the UK, and we're helping actively those customers anticipate what that would mean for their supply chains, what that would mean for their people, whether they have to sit here or in other places. For us as an organization, because we have many different customers in different areas of the globe, we invoice in different currencies, it doesn't necessarily have a huge impact on
on the way we do business on a global scale. We manage these types of complexities, whether it's in Latin America, within difficult to reach countries where we have high inflation or other issues, or whether it's in Asia or in the rest of Europe. I think that doesn't necessarily influence us. I mean, the European Union is a very large customer of ours as well. And this is not because we're British, but this is because, you know, they think we deliver really good services for them. And I don't see that influence at all. We have legal entities in all countries in Europe, so we're going to be able to deal with those issues when they come along. But clearly, you know, if a scenario hits us that that is negative for the UK, and clearly we are part of BT Group and we are in the UK.
Right. It's John Carrigan from Numis. I'll ask two questions, if I may, please, in case you don't want to add anything further for the first question. So last year, your operating free cash flow margin was 2%. For the group as a whole, excluding global services, it was 18%. From everything that you said, I don't really know what the upside is. Given that the difference is massive, is it 1 or 2 points, or is it 4 or 5 points, or whatever? Whatever you can say to help us try and bridge this massive difference between 18 and 2 would be useful. And then secondly, clearly you haven't wanted to say much about potential disposals. Can you just give us some comfort that those assets are valuable to others? Maybe by talking about some of them, please. So I recall Gavin a year and a half ago saying that there's more than one buyer for some of these assets. Anything you can give us by way of comfort would be useful.
Well, on the first question, I don't think we can get. Yeah, you can.
Yeah, just to comment, as I was saying, through the actions we're taking, through the improving EBITDA margin, ultimately improving EBITDA combined with the lower capital investment, we are expecting sustained improvement in our free cash flow. And that will clearly close the gap from where we are today of the 2% towards the 18. Given the nature of the business, you're not going to get towards the 18. And I'm not going to give you just the sort of profile of where we're going to end up in the next few years. But it is fair to say it will be a multiple of the government that we will see progressing over the next 2 years.
Yeah, and your question on comfort with regard to the fact that our assets are valuable, I think it's a difficult question to answer without becoming specific, and I do not want to become specific, unfortunately, at this point in time. But what I can say is that the assets that we see as non-core within the strategy, some of them are underutilized. So maybe the actual return on capital employed that we get out of it by focusing on our customers, somebody else can utilize those assets better than we can, and therefore those assets are very valuable for other people and other companies. And it varies a lot where you look across the asset base that I showed earlier. Some of the areas, for example, in data centers, you know, some of our data centers are very small, and it's more beneficial just to close them down to move the traffic and the workload into Amazon and Microsoft rather than to keep it open or even to divest it. So there's a mix of these types of actions across all our assets. But it is not. I mean, we've taken, and you saw this in the numbers for last year, where the revenue went down substantially. We've taken action on the zero margin revenue that we've seen quite drastically. The assets we currently hold might be underutilized, but they're not heavily loss-making as we have with the first action. So if we have companies that want to buy, or if we have means by ourselves to utilize these assets better than we do today, then clearly those assets are very valuable. Right.
Yeah, morning. It's Guy Petty from Macquarie. Two quick questions. I'm sorry to come back to the return on capital employed thing, but you implied earlier that a lot of it's already set for the next 2 years because of the decline in D&A. So I interpret that right, that you probably already have very good visibility on what the improvement will be in return on capital employed because of the decline in D&A line. Should we expect D&A to converge down towards your new CapEx either like on a one-to-one ratio. On a secondary question, you talk in your cost base about obviously bringing costs down, and in particular I'm interested in the third-party telco infrastructure costs. I can see why you can probably bring those down, but as you move to a more asset-like model, will you be buying more volume of those as well, so there's going to be a pull and a push, i.e. you're actually paying more because of a bigger array of services?
Yeah, good point. On the DNA, yeah, on the DNA, the point wasn't that DNA was coming down, particularly it was that the DNA currently and over the next few years will be quite significantly greater than new capital investment going in, and therefore over time putting down capital employed. Clearly over time DNA will reduce, and so that's more in the sort of 3-5 year time frame where you'd expect to see the more closely aligned.
And you're right. Costs will go up, variable costs will go up if we use excess providers to reach buildings rather than our own infrastructure. But as we buy from organizations that are more efficient in providing that access than we can do ourselves, that will eventually have a benefit in our underlying cost base. We have room for one more question. I'm going to go all the way to the left. We started on the right. And we, by the way, have no questions online or on the phone for those that go ahead.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's Paul Sidney at Credit Suisse. Just a quick question, really. I thought it was a bit worrying that only 20% of your top 800 customers took a security service. Does that mean that the other 80% are taking security from someone else, and therefore you have to win market share? Or is it something we actually all have to worry about?
I hope they buy from somebody else, but Mark.
I don't have a specific question. Every time someone buys something from us, they're buying a bit of security. Because, even our core network services, despite the fact it might not be bad security, has obviously security at the top. All our products, consumer products included. And, that the discipline and diligence that we have to ensure that we're always maintaining and becoming and staying ahead of the threat is essential on behalf of all of our customers, regardless if they're specifically buying security services. To get to another question, though, most organizations are in a situation where they do a lot of it in-house. So they've built up their security team in-house, and so I think I quoted one organization when I was talking earlier on, but this is really where they get into. They just bought a lot of stuff in-house. They now realize that they've got a lot of things. They're not really being able to sweat those assets, and it's often huge investments they've made. And they're just literally running out of road, be it skills, be it just the ability to consume new types of technologies which are answering that particular threat that came out yesterday, and then there's another one. This is just getting a world where it's just all really becoming terribly difficult and complicated. So being able to take that capital, if you want, and being able to streamline that, combined with our unique threat hunting capabilities that we have, is what we see. So 20%, yes, sounds low. It's not that they're buying it necessarily. It's also some people are buying services from others. But in the main, what I see is organizations who are doing heavily in-house type activities and are now coming to us and saying, what can you do? Because, you have a bigger scale, bigger insight, you're able to deliver this app in a much more dynamic and virtualized way in the new networking environment that you've been talking about, and faces this huge challenge of how do I help get out my business into take advantage of those cloud-based services that we're talking about, and I've got a bunch of regulators on my back. How can we work together to do that? And that's really where I see the opportunity, which is why I said I'm very confident that we can continue to really achieve the above-market growth rates that we're talking about, with also, as Martin was talking about, often higher margin in the product area as well, just because of the scarcity of the skills.
Just a quick follow-up. Is that a similar dynamic across all the products within global services, the sort of in-house, external fight the business?
No.
Yeah.
In some cases, so you will remember also Cloud DC is as low penetration. In that case, it's also a reflection of technology changes. So we would have customer on different, or solutions that are in the mature state. So it's only one part. The rest of the buy will be customers that buy solution from others, or DIY, or also a solution from us. The migration, the change is our opportunity to bring them onto these new services. And the example that I brought to life, we have designed the solution that way so we can compete against the in-house solution, the different skills they can't replicate, as well as some other forms of competition.
Good. I think, by the way, on the security question, should I be worried? I think a default emotion of being worried is a good one in the case of cybersecurity. Mark has always told me.
Paranoid person in the room by a long way. You'll be glad to hear.
Thank you very much for your time, and we're going to go over to lunch where we can have more questions and answers also with the rest of the leadership team. Thank you very much.